This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. On the program today, the role of government in this economy with one of the women in charge of it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C. today, I'm Kai Rizal. It is Tuesday, the 25th day of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. If you were looking for one place to go to talk about what the Biden administration's plans are for this economy and its plans for America's relationships in the rest of the global economy, the Commerce Department would be a real good place to start. Hundreds of billions of dollars in spending is going to pass through commerce on its way to new semiconductor plants and training facilities over the next decade or two. China and our relationship with Beijing is being shaped at least in part by discussions that are happening in the secretary's office on the fifth floor of the Commerce Building, Gina Raimondo's office, to be precise, which is where we will begin. Madam Secretary, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You are arguably, I suppose, the point person on the Biden administration changing how government interacts with this economy. You have said that the CHIPS Act and all that the Biden administration are trying to do is the biggest industrial policy change in this economy in 70 years. What happens if you don't get it right?
We're going to get it right. I can't I can't even think about that. Look, the stakes are so high. I was this morning with President Yoon of Korea and a group of American and Korean business leaders, and we were just talking about how important it is for us to get this right, to have a secure supply chain, a resilient supply chain on all of these critical technologies, as among us and our allies around the world.
How are you going to know? Because this isn't going to come to fruition for decades if you're lucky.
Yeah, such a good point. So I think there's short-term markers of success, and then, as you say, ultimately long-term. But, you know, a year from now, we will have stood up our semiconductor technology center. It should be a little beehive of activity with entrepreneurs and academics and businesses working together. We will have broken ground on some new semiconductor facilities. Mm-hmm. We will have launched new training programs with colleges, universities, high schools, community colleges. But at the end of the day, it's like 10 years from now, is it half as expensive as it is today to commercialize a new chip? You know, do we have twice or three times as many chemical engineers, electrical engineers, semiconductor technicians? That's when we'll really know.
All right, this is a little sideways. Roll with me here.
Okay.
I was doing a talk to the economics club at my daughter's high school the other day.
Okay.
And this kid asked, not a kid, he's an 18-year-old boy, man, he's going to college next year. And he said, look, super into what you're trying to do here.
Oh.
And he said, look, I understand what the secretary is trying to do, but help me understand why the government has to spend $50 or $80 or $100 billion to help these giant for-profit making gazillions of dollars companies get started here.
So what I figured a smart
kid. He was so sharp.
Young man.
So
that's
sharp.
Quite impressive. Because it's very expensive to build these facilities in America, and left to their own devices, these companies would do what they've been doing for decades and build them in Taiwan, Malaysia, Vietnam, et cetera, where it's 30 to 35% less expensive. So the way I think about it is you wouldn't do this unless it was a real national security priority. So I consider this to be an investment in America's national security.
I'll get to the national security in a minute. Can the United States government get out of its own way to make this happen?
Yes, we already are. You know, we are recruiting a top-notch A-plus team of people from industry and finance executives to do a great job investing the money. We're working with companies. Look, we welcomed statements of interest from companies, and within weeks, we have more than 200 statements of interest from companies from all over the world. So, yes, we're going to make it happen.
There is a little bit of, and I don't want to lose sight of national security because that's important. There is a little bit of social policy in here, right? And specifically, it's making sure workers are taken care of, making sure that the female labor force can participate. How concerned are you about opposition to getting that part of the deal done?
So first of all, I think that's all economic policy, not social policy. I was in a meeting this morning of the Real Estate Roundtable at, you know, big real estate developers. They are so worried that they won't be able to find enough workers to build these facilities. They said right now in America, there's 500,000 open, available, unfilled construction jobs. Hmm. And that's before we start to put any of this money to work. So we need women in order to hit the mission here. Interestingly, I find this fascinating. I have taken some criticism from politicians and some academic economists who have criticized this as quote-unquote social policy. Mm-hmm. I have heard no complaints from anyone in industry. Hmm. It's really interesting. I've talked to all the companies in the chips ecosystem, mm-hmm. in the supply chain. They say, yeah, makes perfect sense.
I will put that on my list of questions to ask companies. It's because it's a really good point. Here comes the softest of softball questions ever. You ready?
I'm ready.
China, discuss.
Oh, China. China, discuss. Oh my! In 2 seconds or less.
No, you got all the time in the world.
You know, you're kind. Yeah, China's our biggest strategic competitor. You know, huge country, huge economy, and we are in a pretty fierce competition with them. So how do we do that? We invest in America first and foremost. By far the most important thing we can do is invest in our people, our technology, our innovation, our infrastructure, everything President Biden is doing. And then, you know, we have to protect ourselves, right? We would be foolish to let China have access to our most sophisticated artificial intelligence chips, which they don't have, they can't make, and they want to put in their military equipment. So it's competition, like any intense competition. You have to cooperate where it's in your interest. You have to engage pretty continuously. Lack of communication can only lead to conflict. But mostly, like, let's be the great America that we are.
Secretary Yellen said in a speech the other day, and in fact, she said on this program a month or two ago, we have to put a floor under our relationship with China, right? We don't want to decouple. We have to be engaged. That said, if you get a call from your counterpart in Beijing, would you go?
I would certainly think about going, yeah. I mean, we want to get
back. Think
about
us not going.
No, I would go. I would go because, look, here's why. We need to get back into, like, what I would call regular order. You know, no one went to China during COVID for a very long time. I talked to chief executives who've been doing business in China for 30 years. They haven't been in 3 years. So we have to get back to regular communication. Yes, I look forward to that. I look forward to hosting my counterpart here. And, you know, we got to get to the business of doing that.
Do you ever look back on your years in venture capital as you disperse money, you know, much, much larger amounts of money, but you're like, I've done this before. I know how to do this.
Yes. Yes. Listen, I'm approaching this work with humility and caution and the sense of the weight of the responsibility. Your first question, what happens if you fail? That's a immediately I break out in sweats and hives. Can't fail. But yes, I'm comfortable with this. I'm comfortable with the financial aspect of this. I'm comfortable negotiating on behalf of, you know, America and our taxpayer dollars. I'm comfortable pushing companies and making this a fair, but not, it's not a blank check. I've had an ability to recruit an unbelievable top tier team. So yes.
Is it fair to say that you're trying to not reimagine, but reinvigorate what this department does? You are, I mean, look, you're getting a lot of press. Mm. You're getting a lot of attention. This department's getting a lot of attention, partly because of the CHIPS Act, partly because of China. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what your take is on how you're being perceived.
I never think about how I'm being perceived.
Oh, come on.
I really don't. Anyone who knows me when I was in elected office, it was obvious I wasn't motivated by getting reelected because I always took on the biggest fights if I thought that was necessary.
There's the politician in you speaking out. I mean,
no,
come on.
No, it's a fact.
Okay.
Look what I did. Truck tolls, pension reform, school reform, the whole thing. But anyway, this is a great place to be right now. The Commerce Department is in the bullseye of what matters. Technology, China, industrial strategy, supply chains. It is the place to be, and I'm just trying to do the best I can to lead it.
Madam Secretary, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
What word shall we use, do you suppose, for the current situation in the banking sector? There was the acute phase, Silicon Valley Bank and Signature. There was Credit Suisse over in Europe after that. First Republic gave people a scare a couple of weeks ago. And today we learned of, maybe we call it another First Republic wobble. How about that? The bank reported this morning customers withdrew more than $100 billion in deposits in the first quarter. That's the way bank runs go, right? People just get nervous when other people get nervous. But there is more to the financial system and financial wobbles and crises than just banks. The Treasury Department's got a new proposal out on how it regulates what are known as non-banks. Marketplace's Justin Ho is on the What's in a Name desk today.
Non-banks are kind of what they sound like. They provide financial services to the public, but they just aren't banks.
Insurance companies, mortgage companies, payday lenders, fintech platforms.
Cornelius Hurley teaches bank services law at Boston University. He says non-banks played a big role in the 2008 financial crisis. AIG, Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers. So in 2010, the Dodd-Frank Act allowed the Treasury Department to determine whether banks and non-banks alike are systemically important.
If you are systemically important, you are going to be subject to intense, and I mean very intense, regulatory oversight.
But in 2019, the Trump administration added several steps to the process of determining whether a non-bank is systemically important. Catherine Judge, a professor at Columbia Law School, says the changes bog things down.
If you create a process that has too many different steps, effectively what you are creating is a process that can never be used.
Right now, the federal government doesn't consider any non-banks to be systemically important. The Treasury Department's new proposal would speed up the process of deciding whether a non-bank needs more regulation. Jonathan Macy, a professor at Yale, says that's not necessarily because regulators see any non-banks waving red flags.
I think what they see is simply how red flags are in a way useless, right, in this context, because these runs can occur so quickly.
And even quicker at a non-bank, Macy says, if investors all decide to pull their money because they're worried the federal government won't show up with a bailout.
To bail out hedge fund investors and large institutional investors who put their money in these non-banks, the justification for that is significantly weaker in my view.
Macy says that's why the government is better off stepping up regulation so non-banks don't go belly up in the first place. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Lots of housing news out there today. Home prices were up in February for the first time in 8 months, by the by. That is according to the latest Case-Shiller Home Price Index. Also, the number of new home sales was up almost 10% in March. That's from the Department of Housing and Urban Development and the Census Bureau. The caveat here, of course, is that two data points do not a trend make, but we can pretty readily infer that the housing market is still tight. Supply is low, prices and mortgage rates are still high. So affordability is a challenge. Starting the 1st of May, though, conditions are going to ease just a bit for some low and middle income buyers because mortgage fees for loans banked by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are changing. Marketplace's Samantha Fields explains that one.
When most people think about buying a home, they tend to focus on two expenses, their down payment and their monthly mortgage payment. But Jenny Schutz at the Brookings Institution says there are a whole bunch of other fees, too.
Some go to the lender. You pay things like broker's fees that go to the realtor. You pay closing costs, which go to cover a variety of things like title insurance.
And those costs can add up to thousands of dollars.
For people who are stretching to make the down payment and get in, this can be a hurdle.
Sometimes the hurdle that prevents them from buying. The Federal Housing Finance Agency is trying to change that equation. That's why it's changing one of those fees called loan level price adjustment for the more than half of buyers who get loans backed by Fannie and Freddie. The fee will go down for buyers with smaller down payments and buyers with lower credit scores.
Those two changes together will have a major impact on the affordability for borrowers, particularly those with low and moderate incomes.
Vanessa Perry is at the George Washington University School of Business.
And that really matters in, you know, the current or price environment where house prices are so high and have essentially skyrocketed over the past few years.
This change is designed to save lower income buyers money, says Mitria Spotzer at the Center for Responsible Lending. Often a few thousand dollars, which is enough to make the difference for some people.
It expands access by making home ownership more accessible to a broader scope of folks.
As part of this change, too, buyers with very high credit scores and more money to put down will see their loan level price adjustment go up slightly starting in May. But they'll still be paying a smaller percentage overall. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The feel-good factor doesn't seem to be legal tender.
Oh, that it were so easy. First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, the Wawa's today is Dow Industrials dropped 344 points, about 1%, 33,530. The NASDAQ down 238 points, that is almost 2%, 11,799. The S&P 500 gave back 65 points, just over 1.5%, 4,071. We heard from Samantha Fields about a coming change in mortgage fees and from Justin Ho about the federal government looking at tighter regulation of non-banks, which include mortgage lenders. Thus, Loan Depot, which lost 6.7% today, LendingTree fell about 5.8%. It is still bank earnings season. First Republic, we mentioned First Republic shares tumbled 49.5% today. Ouch. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's a speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you've been on a plane lately, you know it's crowded up there. Full flights as far as the eye can see. And sure enough, if you check the TSA's passenger numbers, how many people go through security at airports every day, turns out it's almost exactly the same now as it was in the before times. 2.4 million people in the flying public yesterday, just about the same back on April 24th, 2019. But the mix of travelers and the price of getting on that plane, oh, that's changed a bunch since then. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is on that one.
Just wait in line to clear security for a flight these days, or try to find room for your carry-on in the packed overhead bins.
Leisure travel has really come roaring back.
Lindsay Roschke at polling firm Morning Consult says a lot of consumers are still flush with savings from the pandemic.
people are excited to travel after a couple of years of really pulling back because they missed out on travel for so long.
Revenue from business travel, though, is still down more than 25% since the pandemic hit.
That could be partly due to the rise in work from home technologies, now with fears of a recession looming, tightening corporate travel budgets.
Chris Raitt at research firm ThirdBridge says here's what he's hearing from corporate travel agencies.
On those business travel trips, they're now sending less employees than they had historically, less frequency throughout the year.
Problem is, before the pandemic, corporate travelers, often buying business class seats at the last minute, accounted for as much as 70% of airlines' profit. But Raitt says another new trend is helping the airlines.
The uptake of the premium cabin by leisure travelers. So we've actually seen consumers with a propensity to spend.
And they sure are spending. Prices, wherever you are in the airplane, remain high. Morning Consult's Lindsay Roschke has been traveling recently.
A beach vacation in Mexico earlier this year, just came back from a couple weeks in Sweden visiting some family, and they've been great, but also clenching my teeth a little bit when I'm paying for flights.
Ticket prices have risen nearly 18% in the last year. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
I mentioned inflation over in the UK the other day, 10.1% year on year. It's been above 10% since last July. And food prices over there are up 19% over a year ago, which makes what I'm about to say make some sense. The latest round of labor strikes and stoppages will happen later this week over there. Teachers on Thursday and junior hospital doctors are threatening to go out again not long after their recent four-day walkout. The government, though, is planning a crackdown on essential services strikes, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now from London.
What do we want?
Pay restoration!
When do we want it?
Now!
8 years into her career as a hospital doctor, Naomi Dunn is on the picket line, demanding a big increase in pay.
At this point in my career, I should be able to at least comfortably afford to pay for childcare, pay mortgages.
And you can't pay for childcare, and you can't meet your mortgage payments?
Like a lot of my colleagues, I'm struggling.
The doctors earn between $37,000 and $78,000 a year. They want a 35% increase to make up for what they say they've lost through inflation over the past decade. As a result, says junior doctor Michael McArdle, there's been an exodus of medical staff from Britain's National Health Service, putting intolerable pressure on those that remain.
Stress and burnout is at an all-time high. Overall morale within junior doctor cohorts are just profoundly bad at the minute.
Gaps in the workforce have led to overcrowded hospitals and poor healthcare, says Naomi Dunn.
I was getting on the back of ambulances to assess patients with hip fractures, and they were then being taken off ambulances to be x-rayed and put back on an ambulance because there is nowhere to put them.
The government says 35% is unaffordable and could trigger a wage price spiral. Hospital bosses, meanwhile, have accused the strikers of endangering patient safety. But Naomi Dunn says better pay for doctors will improve recruitment and retention and healthcare.
These gaps will be filled and hospitals will be safer for it and patient safety will be better for it.
A similar dispute over pay, recruitment and retention has been festering in another essential public service.
Good morning, children.
Good morning, Mr. Thornhill.
Teachers in public schools will go on strike for 2 days over the next couple of weeks in a long-running campaign for higher pay.
My pay, in real terms, has dropped by 20% over the last 10 years.
Claire Selby has been a teacher for 16 years. She works a 60-hour week for around $50,000 per annum and says she's struggling. But the critics say teaching's a vocation. It's about so much more than money. The real reward is the feel-good factor.
That's very true. It is a vocation. But unfortunately, I find that when I go to the shops or when I'm paying a bill, the feel-good factor doesn't seem to be legal tender.
At this high school, language teacher Charlotte Nash is also planning to join the strike for a raise that at least matches the current rate of inflation, 10.1%. But the strike will mean more disruption for the kids' education, which suffered horribly during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Do you not, hand on heart, feel just a little bit guilty about taking this action?
Yes, I do. I really do. But it isn't just about pay.
It's about recruitment and retention, she says, and ensuring that any pay hike is funded with fresh government money.
It's about making sure that our schools are funded properly.
Alarmed by the wave of strikes in essential public services, the government has introduced a bill providing that key workers who fail to maintain a minimum level of service during a strike can be fired. Junior doctor Naomi Dunn.
It just makes me extremely angry to stomp down on free speech and people's ability and right to strike.
But teacher Charlotte Nash sees the government move as futile.
If all of us lost our jobs because we had taken strike action, this school would close.
It's not a credible threat, in other words.
I really don't see it as such.
In fact, the strikes appear to be paying off. The rate of public sector pay hikes has more than doubled to 5% over the past few months, almost catching up with the growth in private sector salaries. It remains to be seen whether all this will give an upward twist to the UK's vertiginous inflation rate. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, there is some new data from Glassdoor that we got today. It's about internships, specifically how much they pay. The average intern, Glassdoor says, makes $24.63 an hour. That is an 11% bump from a couple of years ago. 87% of paid interns say they make at least $15 an hour. Always pay your interns, by the way. The highest paid internship, the payment company Stripe. Average intern pay there, $9,064 a month. All right, out of here we are. Not, of course, without your moment of economic context. Perhaps not surprising this one will be as the recession vibe takes slightly firmer hold out there. The Conference Board said this morning that consumer confidence fell this month. To be a bit more specific, we, consumers, that is, right? We feel okay now. It's the six-month outlook that has fallen to its lowest level since July. Our digital and on-demand team includes Kerry Barber, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the Executive Director of Digital and On-Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold the Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold the Story are available now.